Disclaimer. The views and opinions you hear expressed by the participants in the show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show. Hey, everybody. How's it going? All right, so you may have noticed the podcast has been off for a couple of weeks. I'm sorry about that. It was sort of an unintended hiatus, but really we should have announced it because we kind of knew it was coming, so I am sorry about that. But moving forward, I just want to let you know what's up. So a couple of years ago, we had a Anime News Network had a webcomic called Anime News Nina that was really popular, and people really liked it, and had an audience, and fans and everything, and we loved it too, and we really wanted to have another webcomic. And when my boss, Christopher McDonald, came to me and said, "Hey, Zach, we need another webcomic. We should have another comic." And that fell to me. Jacob and I created a webcomic for the site. It's called Vice and Luna. It's going to debut on the site sometime in the next couple of months. Next 2 months. We're thinking early June. That's when we want to start. That's when we want to launch, have the first couple of strips out. It's an interesting concept. You can see some art from it already at Vice and Luna. That's one word. Vice and is one word. Viceandluna.tumblr.com. You can check out. We've got a couple of character designs up. You can see our main two main characters and a few other little drips and drabs. Not a lot of detail there just yet. But that is a big project. We've been working on it for a really long time. I'm so excited to show it to you guys. And I'm so sorry that the podcast has had to kind of go by the wayside a little bit in the last couple of weeks so we could really focus on launching that, because it's been a big project. Anyway, so keep an eye on that, and Ancast might continue to be erratic for a little while. We might need a week off here and there, and again, in advance, so sorry, profound apologies. But eventually we'll get back to our regular schedule, and we'll have our new comic up on the site, and I hope you guys like it. Anyway, check it out, viceandluna.tumblr.com. For now, just for a few little preview images. Hope you like what you see. Anyway, let's get to the Razafon discussion with myself, Jacob Chapman, and Alexander Smith. Thanks for listening, guys. Okay, we're back. Joining us for our series discussion, this time we are talking about the 2002 show Razafon. It's a Bones show from back in the day. Joining us, he's you know him as BioD42 on Twitter, Alexander Smith. Alexander, thanks for coming on the show.
Good to be here. Thanks.
Okay. All right. So this is Razafon. We've been actually meaning to get to this, I feel like, for a long time. I feel like I put it off. Like, Razafon, I remember loving it, and I remember it being terrifically dense, like a lot to take in.
Right.
And so I think that's why I was kind of putting it off, but we finally got around to it, and I sort of ingested the show very quickly over the last, like, week or two. Yeah, so usually when we start these things, we talk about kind of how we came to the show in the first place, how we discovered it or whatever. Jacob, do you want to start with that?
I first watched this show shortly after seeing Evangelion for the first time when I was, like, 16, 17. And I didn't really take to it. I didn't really cotton to Evangelion much. And so people mentioned Razafon to me as, like, an alternative. Like, I think on the ANN forums I was discussing, oh, yeah, Evangelion, I was kind of disappointed by it. And people said, well, you should try Razafon because it's kind of like a response to Evangelion that's very different. And I was like, oh, okay. And I watched it, and I agreed with that assertion that this was, like, a thing that was obviously made in direct response to Evangelion and had a very different sort of perspective on its story and characters and stuff like that. And I enjoyed it. I got to the end, and it was dense. It was much harder to follow than Evangelion. It's much more obtuse. It is, like, purposefully surreal and off-putting in many times, while Evangelion is always very, like, raw and direct. Like, even when you don't know what's going on in Eva, you kind of get the basics. Razafon demands you pay attention in order to even follow it. So, but I was, because I was a big dork, and I was, like, super paying attention to all the lore and all the character interactions and stuff, and so I got what happened, and by the time I got to the end, I was like, that was good, I enjoyed it. And then I think I yeah, just kind of casually mentioned it to people as is a good thing if you want to, like, if you want, like, super symbolic, surrealist fantasy sci-fi stuff, kind of like Ava, I would mention it. But I didn't ever rewatch it all the way through until now, since I was 17 or so. So, yeah. Oddly enough, the age of that's the age of the awakening, and Razavon is 17, so, yeah, there you go.
Right. Okay. Alexander, what about you?
So I actually first heard about this series because of Jacob. It was on the his top 25 anime list for That Guy with the Glasses. But I didn't actually watch it until last year when I sort of marathoned the whole damn thing on Hulu in about a couple of days.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, I watched that. I watched the movie right after that, and I was so caught up in the whole thing that I immediately wrote this whole giant essay about the thing, the movie that is, and posted it online. And that is sort of the start of my, let's say, illustrious anime writing career.
Hmm. All right. Well, congratulations.
Hooray.
Yay.
I've been doing it for a long time, I can tell you. It's tough work.
Yeah.
But anyway, okay, so you're a relative newcomer to this. This is still a new thing for you.
Yeah, I saw the whole thing once, but it made an impact.
Right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, as opposed to having seen it 15 years ago. That's what I mean.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, that's what I mean. So I saw this first back when it came out, back in 2002, and you can read my crazy, like, over-the-top hyperbolic reviews of the show from back then. They're still on the site. I thought about, like, you know, I really don't agree with these anymore. Maybe I should consider taking them down, but, you know, I can't do that. I gotta leave them up. But, yeah, those are over-the-top. I was really excited, I think, to see something that was, like, felt like, you know, oh, this is being written, like, explicitly for adults. Like, it's complicated and has a lot of characters, and it's very sort of stoic and all that stuff. And at the time, you know, I was, like, 23 and sort of obsessed with being, like, I'm an adult now, and this show is for, you know, it's, I don't want to, like, sit here and, like, calm myself on my shit, but that's kind of what I was doing back then, I think, a little bit. I have the clarity of hindsight now, I think, but it's just kind of funny going back and looking at it. I've been doing this for a while, so you have these weird opportunities to, like, look back at yourself from 10, 12 years ago. Thing is, I did revisit this show in 2012 for our Revenge of the 2000s podcast, and I went back and listened to what I said. It was my number three. I gave it really high remarks. I said, like, yeah, it totally holds up. I don't agree with myself from back then. It's not that good, but it's still really good. And the thing is that I remember revisiting the show in 2012, and I blew through it pretty quick, like the same time I did now, but my reaction to it this time, honestly, was very different. And, like, I've been through a lot of changes and everything. You know, I've changed a lot over the last 5 years even, but I was a little surprised that my reaction now is very different from where it was even 5 years ago, back when we taped the Revenge of the 2000s show. So, yeah, I'll get into it. I'll talk a little bit about that. Anyway, let's start talking about it, because this was a passion project for Bones. It was hugely hyped up. It has this, like, all-star cast of writers. This is, like, the
director is, yeah, like, a design guy. Like,
yeah.
He's an art guy. Art.
So. Right. So, I mean, Jacob, can you talk a little bit about the show's pedigree?
Yeah, so this was early Bones, and I don't know a whole lot. I know that Bones was largely formed off of the Bebop crew from Sunrise, kind of splitting off a little bit. Like, I know that's kind of a little bit of where Bones came from, but Razavon was a couple years into Bones' history, and it was basically the passion project of Yutaka Izubuchi, who is a... I don't know a whole lot about his work, because he's, like, really... He's a mech guy. He's a, like, gears and statuettes and, like, intricate art displays kind of guy. Like, he is a design consultant on, like, mechs and setting design. You know, he's an art guy. And so, rather than a story director type like Hideaki Anno, but obviously, so he went into this, like, with okay, this is my my take on Evangelion, which obviously inspired him. And it's very different. Like, his design aesthetic is very different, whereas the Evas and the angels and stuff like that are all very, like, carnal and, like, bone and muscle and sinew. His robots and his stuff is very, like, it's kind of based on the whole thing of, like, people being created from the earth. It's, like, golems and clay and blood and water and stuff like that. And so, so he was basically him making his Evangelion, but he's not a writer, so he brought on, rather than most, I feel like most series have, like, a series composer who writes everything. This was like, okay, this is secretly my story, Yutaka Izabuchi, but I don't write, as evidenced by the first episode, which is probably the weakest written, and that's the one he wrote. And the rest of it is written by this, like, slate of extremely prolific and talented but very, like, diverse sci-fi type writers. Chiaki J. Kunaka, Hiroshi Onogi, Ichiro Okuchi, everybody's favorite, and who's currently writing Cabinary there in Fortress.
Okay.
Sho Ayakawa, Yoji Enokido, who, if I had to guess if somebody was a series composer voice on this, like, there might not have really been one, but if I had to guess who it was, I would say Yoji Enokido, based on how it's written. But yeah, so it's just basically like, this guy's like, here's my artistic vision, here's a bunch of talented writers, help me script it, and then just, you know, boom. So it's like he had this big timeline, and people broke it down into, like, events that would make sense.
Yeah, it's kind of a perfectly composed, it's an attempt at making sort of a perfect composition, so to speak. It feels like he just collected this sort of brain trust, and like, here, we're gonna one-up Eva. Let's one up Eva. Here we go.
I don't know if his intention was to one up Eva in terms of story or certainly cultural impact. I think he just wanted to one up it visually.
Yeah. And we've been talking about how Razafon is to Evangelion as Cabinary is to Attack on Titan. Yeah. Which is I feel a magnificent comparison. and very apt.
At least there aren't vampires in it, but that might explain the focus on blood.
Right.
Well, anyway, so I guess we should talk about what in the world Razafon is about, which is an issue of some consternation and debate if you ask people who have watched it, because the show is so goddamn complicated. Jacob, can you give us a sort of basic-ass version of the Razafon story?
Yeah, okay, so the basic-ass version is that thousands of years ago.
All right.
Thousands of years ago, there was this this extremely technologically advanced people called the Moo. The Moo, the Moolians, whatever you want to call them. And it's based on, I forgot what he, like, what is it, like the Nahuatl or the, he dug deep mythologically to find this.
Oh, yeah.
It's based you've heard of the Nazca lines. Whoever's responsible for that. It's that people.
It should be the Mayans.
But he doesn't specifically mention the Mayans. I mean, the Mayans get mentioned once because this takes place in 2012, so guess what?
Mayans is Middle America. That'd be either the Aztecs or the Incas.
Yeah,
sure, okay.
It's a mix of different mythology from that region. But either way, he dug deep to come up with this. But it's basically like, those are the, like, fallen from hubris kind of ancient technologically advanced people. You see something like that in Escaflowne, you see it anytime there's a thing with Atlantis in it. Well, in this case, it's the Moolians. And so the Moolians became so technologically advanced, they invented, like, a reality engine that could shape the world into whatever perfect form. But they screwed it up, and they split the world in half. And now, there was a new Earth with, like, a new chance to evolve human life, and those became humans. And then there's the Moolian world, which is like our Earth, except it's fucked up, and they all have to live on, like, floating cities because they fucked up the Earth. And the Moolians want to take back, that they want to combine these two dimensions so the world's not out of balance anymore. And their plan to do this is basically the entire plot of the show. All that stuff I just said is never explicitly explained to the audience.
Yeah.
It is dropped through hints and clues and little bits and pieces across sort of a Monster of the Week type format.
Yeah.
And the actual Monster of the Week type format, that human sort of side of it, that simple human side of it, is a story of Ayato Kamina, who is the protagonist. He's a normal, super normal 17-year-old boy who likes painting pictures and stuff like that. And he finds out that the world that he lives in is inside of a giant orange bubble on the face of the planet called Tokyo Jupiter.
And 3.5 minutes in. Yeah. And we're sort of getting there.
It's hard. I'm doing my best to be expedient.
You're doing a wonderful job. And this is not about the job you're doing. I'm just Razafan, for fuck's sake. Anyway, yeah, so please go on.
You can think of this bubble as
Tokyo,
like...
Tokyo Jupiter, though.
Yeah, you can think of Tokyo Jupiter as like, okay, so if the two dimensions, if the human dimension is like your skin, and the Mulian dimension is like the oil under your skin, and they don't like... Then Tokyo Jupiter is like a pimple that comes out on the face of the Earth. I feel like this is the best explanation I can muster, where it's like, this is the dimension where... Yeah, this is the dimension where the Mulians can come to Earth and can influence it. And so there's all these humans who are trapped inside this bubble of that used to be Tokyo, this is big orange bubble, and there's Mulians like basically controlling their brains and breeding them for perfect Mulian expansion and stuff like that. And so Ayato lives in this environment, and he's about to be used for his purpose now that he's reached the age of 17. He's like he's the god that will combine the two dimensions. But he gets sprung from Tokyo Jupiter by a girl... A woman who is, like, in her 20s, who is working for, like, humanity's fight back against the Mulians. So she springs him out of Tokyo Jupiter, she takes him to the real world, and it's kind of revealed that they were, I guess the ultimate reveal of the show and the core of the show is that they were lovers, that they were teenage heartthrobs for one another, but they got separated when this Tokyo Jupiter thing happened, and because she was on the outside, she's able to take him out and say, like, oh, you don't have to, this doesn't have to be your purpose, you can live just for, like, for love and connection with other people instead mm-hmm. of this, like, crazy Mulian power fantasy that he's been raised to fulfill. And, yeah, and then it's just a bunch of characters and a bunch of fights and a bunch of, like, complex symbology and stuff like that in the run-up to that. But that's the core of the story.
Yeah, and within that framework, roughly 2 dozen characters all having intertwining and interlocking storylines that that eventually feed into the main theme of the show. And,
yeah, just like Evangelion has just Rizko. Like,
and, you know. Yeah, a lot like Evangelion,
yeah,
in fact.
Yeah.
So, I mean, usually we spend a lot more time kind of running down the plot, but frankly, like, we could... That was a really good, sum-up. Within that framework, there's a bunch of gobbledygook. That,
a lot.
Like, I just...
A
like,
lot.
We... Sitting here and explaining it is kind of a... I feel like it would take too long. So, what I want to do is kind of get to the point on Razafan and Alexander... Why don't we start with you? Let's start with the surface. What you liked about Razafan on its surface, without getting into too much of the thematic stuff, just as a show, how did you feel about Razafan?
Well, don't really mull about the thematic stuff, but just on the surface, I really appreciated the Middle and the South American influences. That's not something you see a lot in anime, mm-hmm. Especially not in mech anime. So I thought that was a really interesting counterpoint to the Christian influences that you see in Evangelion.
Mm-hmm.
I went back to listen to the soundtrack later, and I didn't really care for it, but it worked very well in the moment. And the rest of what I really liked is you've got a lot of super complicated family dynamics at play in the series. So you've got people who are mothers or adoptive mothers and brothers, older brothers that are actually younger because the thing is that in Tokyo Jupiter, time moves less fast. So a lot of people, which is how the heartthrob thing worked. I thought that was... If not deep all the time, I thought it was a lot of fun just for personal drama.
Mm-hmm.
And on the surface, that's what did it for me.
What about you, Jacob?
More than anything, I appreciated the aesthetic.
Right.
The big clay golems that are filled with sort of blood and like earth and water and like rushing currents, like that's cool. Like you don't see like mechs. You see mechs, you know, usually they're made of metal, and Evangelion was unique in that they were made of meat, and then now here's robots that are made of clay. And it was really cool. I think one of my favorite episodes is when you discover there's like a it's like a broken baby clay golem that one of the poor kids that's you know his he's basically the Asuka of Razaphon. His name is Makoto Ishiki.
Hmm.
He fills Asuka's role, although he doesn't have a relationship with the main character. Other than that, he's the same like emotionally. And he bonds with this little broken baby clay golem, and it's so cute. It has one eyeball, and it's just like a hunk of rock that floats and makes little noises and shimmers when you touch the surface of it. And it's like, oh, you know, it's just unique.
And of course, it must die.
And then it dies, but that's okay because it was just like it wasn't really alive. It was just being brought to life by that kid's feelings. But anyway, like the golems. That's the thing. The golems aren't alive by themselves like Evangelions. That's a very important distinction. The Evangelions have their own will. It's like the will of the parent or whatever. And the golems in Razaphon are the will of your sort of subconscious, selfish human. So, like the idea is that humans and Mulians are sort of like dual to one another. Like the Mulian part is the aspect that sort of desires power and sees love as a like an extension of what can this person give to me, I guess, mm-hmm. which is why when Ayato sees the Mulian part of it, the Ixchi, the thing that's compelling him to drive the Razaphon, it is in the form of the girl that he lost. But the girl that he lost is still there. She's real. She exists. She's a person. But he sees that his desire is for this perfect thing that he lost. And so, anyway, point being, the golems aren't actually alive. But they are driven by your subconscious sort of desire.
Well, it's like in Sailor Moon when, you know, the girl, like you know, she gets dumped by her boyfriend and then the emotions cause her to turn into a monster or whatever, right? Like, that happens.
It's like that, yeah. So, and that happens in Ava, too. But in Ava, it's based on, like, insecurities about feeling inferior to what's expected of you. And in Razaphon, it's about sort of the idea that love and desire can come from a very selfish place.
Yeah.
And
The characters are sort of hulking out on loneliness.
Yes, hulking out on loneliness. Hulking out on is a desire to be worth something, but, you know, for their own personal reasons rather than... you're right, there's like a lot of twisted parental dynamics in this and a lot of twisted family relationships. It doesn't... it's not like Evangelion where it feels like this guy maybe had a bad relationship with family. It just feels like they're there for twists. But the emotional issues that he's going through are very individual. They're not really related to family dynamics being bad, I guess.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, we'll get into that, the family stuff, because it's really key to the thematic quality of the show. But on the surface, this show is basically tailor-made for me. The is constantly referencing and name-dropping mid-20th century surrealists, which is totally my wheelhouse. Like, those guys, those are my favorite artists. People like Magritte, who they fucking shamelessly steal from through the entire show. They're stealing from mid-20th century surrealists the entire time. Mm-hmm. It's heavily influenced. Now, these are... I shouldn't use the word stealing. They are heavily influenced by it. It is an intentional visual reference to it. Right. But I'm intimately familiar with all that stuff. So I was just... It was Kid in a Candy Store just looking at all the surrealism references. I wish that they meant something, but they don't. So I appreciated all that stuff. And I loved the design of it, all the abstraction, like what you were just talking about, the idea of... A golem that is made out of the fundamental elements of Earth, including blood, is super awesome. That is really unique and a cool idea. And they visualized it beautifully. You know, it's a shame this thing is an old-ass DigiPaint show because it's so good-looking.
They did their best for the technology.
I would like to see these designs and everything rendered in, you know, full HD and everything, but the show still looks fine, I think. I actually really like the character designs, although you and I were disagreeing on this.
On rewatching the show, I think I had a faulty memory of the proportions of the faces bugging.
Yeah, because I liked them a lot. It's a solid, I really like mid 2000s bones.
Uh-huh.
good stuff.
No,
I like
I
those character designs.
I agree.
A lot.
I love the way Wolf's Ring looks, but I guess I my memory of Razaphon was more off model than the actual show is, and it does get off model. But
yeah, for sure. But
of course, but
it's beautiful stuff in it.
I recant what I said about the Razaphon character designs being a little janky. I think they're really good looking for the time.
I'm still kind of like that kind of character design. I appreciate when that shows up, although it's become kind of an indicator of you're watching a serious sci-fi show.
A little bit,
those character designs totally just mean you're watching a serious sci-fi show. So, it had all these catnip references for me, and, like, it seemed... And that's the thing, like, eventually this show became a little... It just became too perfect for me. It's like... but I'm not feeling much.
Yeah, well,
I'm
not
feeling much of anything.
Distant, another hallmark of Early Bones. Emotionally distant.
Which you can't have in a show like this.
Yeah.
Like, you cannot have emotional distance.
I mean, it worked for Bebop and Wolf's Rain.
Those aren't really... Wolf's Rain is dealing with a different kind of a thing. That's dealing with sort of end-of-the-world stuff, which this is dealing with emotional end-of-the-world.
Yes.
The same stuff Evangelion is. And so I feel like that's kind of where it fell down for me. That's where I was like, oh man, I'm not in love with this like I used to. So I guess we should get into the themes here. Jacob Blake, I feel like there's less room for interpretation on this one than on Evangelion. Like, I feel like this show's pretty straightforward, but I could be totally wrong. So why don't you tell me what your interpretation was?
I think you're right that there's less room for interpretation, but Razaphon is also trying to be about more things than it
is. It sure is, yeah.
And Razaphon is trying to be about, like, everything. It's trying to be about, like, the feeling you get when you realize that you're, that you can't go home again, that you can't, like, go back to your childhood and how things used to be perfect, but you realize they weren't ever really perfect. It's about that. It's also about the inherent selfishness of wanting to connect with people who don't want to connect back with you. It is about, like, the value of love over power. It's about all sorts of things. While Evangelion is about depression and feelings of inferiority and insecurity.
Well, okay.
Like,
now, hang on a second. Now, I would argue that everything you just said falls under human connection as the point of living.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
All of that falls under the same umbrella. Form potent connections with the people you love, and that makes life worth living, and create a world where you and yours can thrive.
I'm not saying one is better.
And accept everyone around you for who they are, and accept the world as it is. Yeah. Like, that, the show is very much like, things are good. Like,
yeah, well, I'm not saying this is better or worse. I'm saying Evangelion is more focused. Razaphon is trying to cast a bigger umbrella.
For sure, for sure. I'm just, like, to me it seemed like, yeah, like, it seems like it's trying to say a lot of stuff, but now that I think about it, they're all sort of the same thing.
They are, yeah.
You know, the nuance is really good, and you definitely want to have, like, a wide cast of characters, because if you want to iterate on that theme or have, like, okay, well, I also want to talk about it in this kind of relationship, and then I also want to talk about that theme in this kind of relationship, you can do that with the 50,000 characters that Razaphon has.
Right.
And there were moments, like, there's a lot of really great character moments in it that really pay off, even for a lot of the supporting cast. But it's all in service of the one thing, which is togetherness, and that's a wonderful message. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't
Evangelion comes from a place of emotional rawness, I think, because Anno is bleeding his personal feelings into it.
Not a lot of blood in this one.
Hey, well, yeah. Razaphon is workshopped. It is. I know what I want this to be about. I'm not a writer, so I will have these writers write it for me. And the writers all have different ideas about, like, that there are episodes that come across a little bit passionless, like they are just telling a backstory. And then there are episodes that are like, oh, this person felt like Makoto Ishiki. Stuff like that, where it's like, it just depends.
Yeah, it's a flawless puzzle box.
Yeah, flawless puzzle box.
Like, you can sit there and pick it up. You can open that up, and you will find references to art and culture from 20th century that stretch into just a huge variety of places.
Like,
art and music and culture, everything you can think of. Like, you can sit here and list them, and they certainly did on the internet. Like, they went through them all and figure out all the lore and the aliens and the humans and figure out what else.
You can figure all that out. Like, Evangelion feels like a sci-fi world that's born out of necessity, out of something somebody wanted to express emotionally.
Well, and it's half written. Yeah. It's half written. Yeah, so all the sentences don't, half the sentences don't finish, and that's part of the fun and the mystery.
Razafun this feels one, like a giant timeline that has this complete world, and then somebody said, okay, fill it with characters and emotions.
And, what,
and somebody did that, but it doesn't have this. It's a different approach.
Yeah. And totally. And my Alexander, you're going to get to speak at some point.
I was about to say,
but I just wanted to get to this point. When I was watching Razafun this time, I realized that back then, when I was 23, what I was doing was saying, like, I'm an adult, and so this adult show is for me. And Razafun is, like, a flawless execution of adult Evangelion. Like, 100%, it is for well-balanced people. It is about balanced people, normal people. Normal people, which is fine and awesome. And the execution, like I said, flawless, is perfect, like Puzzle Box. I want the scribbles. I want the messiness. I want the I want the fucking chaos of Evangelion. I want that's interesting to me. The violent adolescence of Evangelion is what's fascinating to me. If Evangelion is the dingy ass fucked up record store, Razafun is a Crate and Barrel. And Crate and Barrel's nice, and I'm going to go in there and probably buy an absolutely beautiful wall sconce, and everyone who comes to my house is going to be like, where did you get that wall sconce? And it's going to be amazing, but I want to hang out. I feel like my heart's in the record store, and I'd rather hang out there. And if I hang out in the Crate and Barrel too long, I start going a little nuts.
Yeah. Well, the thing that really jumped out to me on rewatching Razafun, because I spent the first time I watched it just trying to figure out what even the hell, but... the second time I watched it for this podcast, I tried to focus more on character motivations and stuff like that. And you're right, there's some really good character moments in it. However, it's interesting to me that Ayato is basically like a blank. He is an everyman to such an extent. Like, he is a blank slate that doesn't really, like, all of Ayato's personal demons, like, you think about Shinji and his personal demons and where they come from. It's a very detailed character study.
Yeah.
Ayato is a very normal guy whose demons all come from circumstance. They come from things that happen to him that are bad. And but underneath that, he doesn't have, like, these deep emotional things that he has to overcome to connect with somebody. The things that are keeping him from connecting with somebody are purely circumstantial. They come from being kidnapped by the Mu and then betrayed by humans and then accidentally killing the girl who loves him. And, you know, one of, like, three girls who love him.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting. It makes for a compelling story. Here's the thing. Razafun is really... If provided you are into really dense sci-fi, Razafun is really easy to watch. Like, you're not going to be bored for a second if you're really into dense sci-fi. Like, you will be bored, absolutely, if you're not. But if you are, like, it's like potato chips. I was just, like, the whole time. I thought it would be hard to rewatch this, but it wasn't. I was just engrossed the entire time. However, like, Ayato's not really a character. Yeah.
Right.
So, you know.
Well, so we have definitely talked it off.
Okay.
Alexander, you gotta tell us. So you obviously attached to this show pretty hard. So what did you think? Thematically, what did it say to you?
So you mentioned this as the great unifying theme that you know what, all we got is each other and just human connection as this sort of fundamental force in the universe.
Right.
I mean, the movie really, really drives us home, but it's very obvious in the series as well. And I like that you have this huge sea of characters and you just see human connection just absolutely failing and burning to the ground.
Yeah, yeah.
Like with this the research assistant who loves the hunky scientist and then goes crazy because things happen. But but even at the very end, it just says, you know what, all of that's awful, but it's worth it anyway. And I just thought that was really great, and I could relate to it. Doesn't feel strong enough, but it resonated with me.
Right. So it sounds like we all sort of agree on what Razafun is saying.
It has less room for interpretation.
Yeah.
It is very concrete because I think that comes from building the world first and the character arc second. Like, there's more room for interpretation when stuff is based in, like, human psychology and emotion or whatever. Like, you might feel differently about somebody's emotions, But, like, when it comes from a, like, this is this and that is that and this is what happens in the plot, there's less room for wiggle, you know.
So was there anything else, Alexander, or was that
kind of it? Was it, what, I mean, so, obviously, I mean, you haven't said much about Ava, and as much as we don't want to sit here and harp on it, I find it kind of impossible to divorce it. It's just so close.
Similar. The last episode just steals shots.
Yeah.
It's hard to ignore.
I was literally just saying that. We were sitting here watching the show, and I'm like, you just took that like, did the exact same shot, the exact same characters, the exact same roles. Like, they don't look the same, but it's the same shot. Like, it gets
giant
really...
white personifications of the main characters.
Yeah, like, it just got way too much at the end. And you know, initially, like, I went back and read my review of that final volume, and I'm like, oh, this isn't that much like Ava. And I'm like, 2003 me, you are crazy. You are smoking something. Because, like, yeah, just, I don't know what the hell I was thinking. Like, and that's the thing. This is a beautiful work of art. It is gorgeous. Like, impeccably made.
You don't want to, like, give people the impression, when the Crate and Barrel comparison, like, you don't want to give people the impression, I was like, oh, this is more product-y. No, it's not product-y. It just has
it isn't. It's product-y in the way that if you walk into an art museum and they have an exhibition of, let's say, fashion. Let's say there's a Chanel exhibition. Mm-hmm. That Chanel exhibition is going to be, first of all, very nicely air-conditioned, so it'll be really pleasant in there. But that Chanel exhibition is going to be elegant and impressive and stately and sort of grand, and you're going to have this, it's going to have its own kind of tone. In that same art museum, you might walk through a Jackson Pollock retrospective, and that's going to feel totally different. The thing is that the Chanel exhibition eventually just starts feeling a little too flawless. And it stops feeling like humans made it. This felt, on rewatching it, like a bunch of people decided they were gonna make the ultimate cerebral psychological mecha show.
Right.
They were like, we're gonna perfect this.
Which has happened many times since. It's just this time they kind of actually
did it.
Yeah,
they kind of did it. I just don't like it as much as the fucked up half written one. Mm-hmm. That's all.
Yeah. Well, what were you saying? Like, so you were asking.
So I saw Evangelion when I was 12. So it was a little too early for it to really resonate with me.
A little bit, yeah.
Goddamn. Like, did it give you nightmares? Like, what?
I don't think it gave me nightmares, but the bit where Unit 1 tears Unit 3 apart is deeply ingrained into my mind.
Yeah.
As is Asuka lying at the bottom of a lake and imagining maggots coming out of her eyes.
Right. Yeah. It's childhood memories.
Yep. they're the best. I've been toying with the idea of going back to that series after. I mean, I don't think I'd resonate with me as much anymore because I've sort of moved past that horrible emotional problems.
Hmm. Well, happy to hear that.
High school was a miserable, fucked up place, but Ava was not part of that.
Right. Well, when you were watching Razafon, obviously, since you didn't really connect much with Ava, this must have felt like, oh, it's like that, but this is more my speed.
Yes.
Yeah. Which I think is a really good argument you can make about Razafon.
Yeah.
That it's going to work for some people way more than Ava.
Yeah, I feel like Razafon is the thing you would show to someone who doesn't have the experience with Evangelion's, like, horrible, depressive anxiety problems, or has already dealt with those.
Yeah, I guess it's like, do you want adolescent screaming or an expensive-looking therapy session?
Yeah.
Like, which one of those?
And it was, I mean, when I was, interestingly, like, and that can change so much over time, because when I was 17, Razafon worked better for me than Evangelion. And now at 26 or so, I find them both, like, sort of equal. Like, I do stand by the thing that I said a long time ago when I first rewatched them, which is, if you made a graph, Evangelion goes higher, than Razavan does. Like, it absolutely goes higher, but it also goes way lower. Razavan is, like, the steady line, like, at an 8 out of a 10. Like,
which is what they were...
8 out of a 10 line, yeah, instead of this 10, 1, 4, 11, you know, yes. Evangelion. And, yeah, like, so to me, both of them are, like, I respect and enjoy both of them. Neither one of them speaks to me very deeply personally, just because they're not about... I don't know. They just didn't really hit home with me deeply. But so now I think of them as kind of equal, weirdly enough. Like, I don't like or dislike one more than the other. I just think that they're both good.
I think putting the two shows together is fascinating. And if you're into one, you should totally watch the other just to see. Mm-hmm. Witness it. Like, yeah, I think in the past people were, like, irritated by the comparison. Or it's like, oh, stop bringing up Evangelion. But I think in hindsight we can look back and have fun with it and say, like, okay, look at these two things. Like, this is obviously a response to this other thing. It is obviously these artists saying, like, we're going to do that, except we're going to just nail it to the wall. Mm. And just as an artistic experiment, it's fascinating to look at. Anime is one of the only places you see anything like this ever happen.
Yeah.
Like, it's the Cabinary and the Iron Fortress Attack on Titan thing is such a weird situation, and this was not quite that bizarre, but, you know, like, it's similar in execution. And
like,
so,
at least Izabuchi didn't work on Evangelion.
Yeah.
Much less direct the whole thing.
Yeah.
That's the thing that galls me about Cabinary. And I like Cabinary, but that's the thing that galls me about it, is like, oh, this isn't just... It would be different if he just never worked on Attack on Titan, but he directed it. So for him to do that is bizarre.
Yeah. Yeah,
he liked
all right,
it
man.
So much he wanted to do it again.
Yeah. Well, geez, does that sum up Razavan? Do we have any final thoughts?
Well, we should ask Alexander because we've been so enthusiastic.
I would feel remiss if I didn't mention the episode where he accidentally kills his not girlfriend.
Oh my god! Yeah, that's funny. I mean, not
because it's so
it's
good.
Funny. I'm
it
sorry.
Was hilarious.
It was funny. I felt really bad for her, but also it was funny because. In a show that is pregnant with meaning, her death is mostly mostly serves to explain part of the lore.
Yeah,
which is that Mulians use human bodies to activate these golems, which is the whole. I mean, on a metaphorical level, it's also like selfish use of a relationship, which is kind of what the Mulians represent. But still, like. We find that out through her horrible, horrible death, which is very sad.
Right, but it's so here's the thing. There's the whole thing about human relationships, you know, connection, that being the fundamental force. That is the most dramatic failure of that in the series, probably. Yeah. And the whole time he's beating this giant clay golem, a new one, and of course screaming that he's going to protect her, the dramatic irony. You have these, she writes in her blood how her feelings, and it shows up in neon lights on the buildings as he's fighting her.
Yeah,
and
he doesn't see it.
It's just so, you were saying about how it's more emotionally distant than Evangelion, which is very much true, but this is so weirdly dramatic compared to the rest of the series, that it just sticks out in my mind every time I think of the series.
That's a good... I'm glad you brought that up, because that's a centerpiece for that show. That whole sequence is obviously like, okay, I have this idea. Let's try and pull it off. Uh-huh. And it's very impressive sequence. It's very, like, super creative. I wish I gave more of a shit about the characters involved in that situation, so then it would have some emotional impact on me. Unfortunately, I did not, but it sure was cool. Mm-hmm. Hey, Boston, why don't you meow directly into the microphone? Everyone will love it. All right. Final thoughts, Jacob?
I enjoyed Razavan the second time around more than I thought I would. I thought it would be like, I gotta re-engage my brain and try to figure out the lore again. But surprisingly, even though I saw it how many years ago? Almost 10 years ago. Like, surprisingly, the story stuck, and I wasn't finding myself trying to figure everything out again. Like, I remembered. So, I mean, it had an impact. Like, I remembered why stuff happened the way it did, and I didn't have to refigure out the lore. So I was just able to appreciate the character interactions, and there's some good ones. Ayato, the protagonist, is not part of those interesting character interactions for the most part. Like, but they do exist, and they're good, and you know, it was a good show, and I enjoyed rewatching it.
Cool. Yeah. I was not stunned, to find out that I don't love it as much as I did. But then again, I'm thinking that my reaction is more like I went back and read those reviews, and I don't know, I was going through something at the time. And now I'm just like, man, I can't, why did I think that this was this great? And, you know, so that's mostly what I've been thinking about in my response to that show is like, now upon rewatching it, is like, why did I think this was so great? So I think I figured it out. The thing is, like, it is a my relationship with it aside.
Yeah.
It is a great show. It looks fantastic. It has a ton of incredibly cool and unique ideas in it, and I highly recommend it to anyone who's interested in that sort of... If you liked or are interested in Evangelion, totally watch the show. It is definitely worth your time. Let's get to some Twitter questions. We got some of them. Yellow Redfield asks, would you argue that Razaphon is more idealistic and less cynical... Yes.
Absolutely. Like,
holy crap, yeah.
Yeah, holy shit. Like, the thing that's keeping from people from connecting in Razaphon is mostly either circumstance or, like, basic emotional issues. Like, little problems, little bad things that have happened to them. Evangelion is, like, you know, like, people destroy each other trying to connect at all. So.
Yeah. It's way less cynical. Yes. Like, this feels almost like the happy Evangelion. Like we said, it's the well-balanced one.
Yeah.
It's for adjusted people.
The worst thing that can happen to you in Razaphon is that you die, but even then you'll come back when the world is remade. Mm-hmm. Evangelion, the worst thing that can happen to you, oh gosh, let's count the things.
Yeah.
You know, the bad things.
That's right. Someone will sing the happy song and get you back to your ideal place in the world.
Yeah. We didn't even mention that the golems fight by using music, so that's another, like, if you're a music snob, like, count the things.
Oh, yeah. The show is... top chock-a-block, I would say, with music references, but just from the arts in general. All right, Custom Zaku asks, do you prefer the ending of the TV show or the alternate version found in the movie? Okay, so I've seen that movie, but I saw it a long time ago. I didn't have time to rewatch it for this. It's just a retelling of the TV show with some changed stuff, right? I don't remember what they changed. Alexander, you could be the dude that tells us about the film.
So here's the thing. In the movie, I mean, it changes, like, a bunch of stuff, mostly to get rid of as many characters as it can.
Can't fit those guys in 2 hours, man.
Which is really fun if you want to obsess over, like, how important this dude is to the plot. Well, is he in the movie? Nope, there we go. But what it does is it changes what retuning the world means. So in the movie, what retuning the world means is that Ayato becomes the observer of the world, and because he observes the world from the outside as this sort of godlike figure, the world can continue to exist in its, you know, correct form. Right. In the series, it's sort of a reboot, like, okay, this is the way the world was supposed to be all along. That includes you, Ayato, growing up with your high school sweetheart and getting married and having children, etc.
Having a child looks
and
exactly
so that's
like
the
your
big
mother.
Difference. Mm-hmm. And thematically, poof. I don't know, it's sort of the difference between the world exists because it's observed. Or the world exists, but it's just not in the correct form yet. And I know it really depends on what you like more. I think that the final conversation so here's the thing we should maybe explain, that the Razaphon, the robot, has a guardian spirit called Ichtil, or however you pronounce that.
Yeah.
Who takes the form of said high school sweetheart and guides the protagonist towards his destiny. But the final conversation that they have in the series and in the movie is very, very different. And I think that it's better realized in the movie and explains more about what's going on and the thematics than the series does. But it really depends on what your personal preference is.
Right. Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, they changed a lot of the family relationships and stuff in there, too. Like, I know they made the relationship with his mother less complicated and stuff, right?
Yeah, it's less complicated. Personally, I prefer the fucked up family dynamics of the series.
Yeah, right. I just don't see any, like, what's the what's the point of trying to condense a narrative like that down to 2 hours? I just don't see
that. Well, they do. I like that they didn't really try, and they just sort of wrote a new narrative that fills a lot of the same plot beats and fulfills a lot of the same thematic ambition.
Well, the DVD's on the shelf, so I'll get back to it at some point.
They're both worth watching.
All right, cool. All right, well, we'll take that as the recommendation. All right. Dragon Pup asks, do you think the Evangelion comparison is fair? Yes.
Yeah.
Holy crap, yeah.
Response, absolutely.
Yes. Awanumis asks, did you guys feel that the last two episodes were rushed? Also, the dub in those episodes felt flat to me. I mean, having just seen it, not really.
No,
it didn't seem rushed to me. What do you think, Alexander?
I don't think I saw the dub, so...
Well, no, really, but do you feel the last two episodes felt rushed?
No, no.
Okay. Yeah, I thought they came to it. Like, this was one of those shows where, like, it's all written out, so you understand everything by the end. It's not that confusing.
Yeah.
By the end, though. It's confusing all the way up till the end, but at the end it makes sense. They just explain shit.
I know, maybe they wanted more of the old Methuselah dude who was controlling things in the shadows.
Hmm.
I think it... I mean, yeah, the whole Bobum thing, like, I understand why he exists plot-wise, but... He mostly confuses you when he like, and it's funny because he's like basically the progenitor of this entire plot. But when he shows up, because he shows up so rarely, it's mostly confusing. You're like, who are you? And it's like, oh, that's the one Mulian that exists on Earth. But they don't really tell you that.
Right. Okay. Let's see here. Anime Wondering asks, what would you say is the show's best asset? The sci-fi themes, the love story, or the general tone and aesthetic? The last one for me.
Aesthetic
for sure.
The way it looks, the visual references, the audio references, the uniqueness of the way that the show is designed is the strongest factor, I think.
Right.
The themes are really important to me, but that aesthetic is its most distinguishing feature.
Okay. MechAnime asks, how does this compare with Eureka 7? Erica 7. I have not seen all of Erica 7.
They don't have really much in common. Like, they're both philosophy-mech sort of shows. And they share some writers. But I feel like Bones' long tradition of philosomech is its own thing.
Mm.
And the closest... Razavan is not only the best one. Sorry, Eureka 7 fans. But it's the best one. It is also the closest to Evangelion, while the others sort of go off in other directions. And, yeah.
Right. Okay. Zinky asks... Razafon and Eric 7 are both post-Eva Mecha romances, but which of the two is more successful purely as a love story? Well, I can only comment on this, but I've rarely heard people praise the romance in either of them.
Really? When Eric 7 came out, people talked about the romance in it a lot.
I'm thinking of a different show. God, Eric 7 is so faded from my memory. I should go back. I'm going to re-answer this question. I mean, I have not seen Erica 7 in a long time, so I guess my answer for this is Razafon, but you've seen Erica 7 more recently, so go ahead.
Oh, it's, Razafon's romance is just an echo of the theme, like, it's just taking the theme and trying to make it, it's sort of symbolic, like, it's the setup of the thing, which is, like, she rescues him from his Mulian destiny because she's human and he learns how to be human by loving her, sums up the entire thing. As individuals, they're not all that complex. I mean, I guess Haruka is, but definitely not Ayato. Erica 7 isn't that heavily symbolic. It's not that thematically brrr, so they're just two people. So I think Erica 7's romance works much better because they're just two people. It's not like trying to turn them into symbols for a thematic thing.
Also, they have 50 episodes, so that helps.
Yeah, that helps too. Razafon, the last two episodes don't feel rushed to me, but the entire story certainly does. They cram that shit in there.
Yeah, it's a huge narrative.
Yeah.
Like, it's just thousands a lot of moving. Yeah,
long.
Thousands of years, lots of moving parts, cast of thousands. Yeah. Yeah.
The funny thing is that the movie almost exclusively focuses on that romance. I mean, they show like two of the 20 mech battles you have in that series. So it actually works out better in the movie than it does in the series.
Hmm. All right. Okay, Yellow Redfield asks, how'd you feel about Ichiko Hashimoto's soundtrack? She hasn't done a lot of anime work, but I've grown to like her crazy jazz. I like the soundtrack to this. It's very unique.
Wasn't this kind of like a joint Yoko Kanno project?
Yeah, there's a... Yeah.
I don't know...
I mean, I don't know the exact thing, but I remember something like that.
Let me see. I don't remember who Ichiko Hashimoto is, but it is a... it's definitely a early Kanno is what it sounds like to me. But,
Maya Sakamoto did the very catchy opening theme.
Yeah, the opening theme's great. I like it a lot.
And Steve Conte is in there briefly. I don't know how to pronounce his last name. But, so I think maybe they were, like, I don't know, they work together, but I think, like, that is sort of like Kanno not really crediting herself mostly. I like the score a lot. However, it is not really a standalone listen score. It is like an accenting moments. It's very ambient. It's very like, I don't know. It's not melodic and catchy and you listen to it for funsies, except for the battle theme, which is, by the way, a very, very direct echo of the Evangelion battle theme, except twisted a little bit. And, so it's kind of, you listen to it in the show. Listening to it by itself, I don't really know that you would get much out of it, but, you know. Again,
I tried. I didn't like it. It works very well in the series, but it does not hold up as a separate thing.
Yeah.
Okay, so Ichiko Hashimoto is actually credited with mostly performance, some composition, but mostly performance, and she played Iota's mom.
Oh, I see.
So okay. I think there's some jiggery pokery in the credits going on there, and I think Kanno was probably involved.
There usually is.
Yes.
Okay. Momaru81 asks, do you think the family dynamics play an important role within the show? Yeah, of course. More so than Evangelion. I mean, so this show is kind of like, you can escape your mom, the world of isolation that your mother created for you, and embrace the world outside and other people and your relationships and everything. Like, that's what this is.
Right.
Evangelion is reject your dad.
Yeah, hopefully your mother is not, as in Razaphon, trying to train you up to be a, like, a tool to be used to recreate the world for a Mulian empire. Hopefully your mom is just trying to protect you because she cares about you.
Yeah. So, however, thematically, like, throughout Razaphon, family dynamics are, like, more important, and it's more about that. Like, every character's storyline is tied into the idea of family being really important. So, yeah. Which is really
there
a thing you
so
see.
There's so much sibling envy in that show.
Yeah, totally. Okay. All right. Last question. Trillion22 asks, is Razaphon too crowded? Does it have too many characters such that when some went undeveloped or underdeveloped?
Yes, but so does Evangelion. Like, the Bridge Bunnies are the Bridge Bunnies, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, Ayato's dad gets zero development.
That's curious. They're like, here's our Gendo. He's not important.
Because Ava has Gendo.
His genetic material matters. He does not. So, yeah.
Yeah.
He has a cool eye patch.
Yes.
You can't just have Gendo again. It has to be the mom.
Yeah,
of course.
It has to be the mother. Yeah.
Of course, it has to be that.
So, they're the mother.
That's the first thing they came up with.
And they're like,
all right. Okay, so we're gonna have big.
What's his mom?
We're gonna have big. We're gonna have a big clandestine world destroying system that we will give you like little tiny peeks at what it really means, and you'll be confused. And then there'll be a domineering parent, and then a child who's sort of thrust into the situation. Okay, so when Evangelion though, it was his dad. Well, what should we do?
Well, I like the second part of that, which is, but Rei is his mom in Evangelion, and we need a Rei. Like, we need a Rei. It's a centerpiece. Okay, so his mom is actually his
also
aunt.
His mom.
Yeah, well, yeah, his mother, yeah. We still have Rei, who is his biological mother, but the mother figure is his aunt.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Ha! Gotcha.
Right. Well, technically, yeah. Right. Okay, actually, that wraps us up. Okay, Alexander, thanks so much for coming by and talking about the show with us. It was an enlightening experience.
Great to be here.
Thanks a lot. Okay, that's our show. Big thanks to Alexander for stopping by. The theme song is Bucharest. It's by the band The New Division. You can check it out at newdivisionmusic.com. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes, leave us a rating or review. We really appreciate it, and I'll see you all next week.